Welcome to the Gig Ready Podcast. So excited to have you here. We have a great show for you today. And whether you're from the touring industry or the corporate events industry or somewhere in between, we want you to know that we are here to help you learn and get better at what you do each and every day. This podcast is a little bit different than most. I'm not going to sell you on something. I'm not going to promote some product here. We merely want to give you value that you could give value back to us. That's what we call value for value. And each and every one of you are a part of this show as a producer, as someone who can contribute to this show. A couple of ways you can contribute. Number one, tell your friends. Let them know what we're doing and how we can help them become better professionals. Number two, leave us a review on iTunes. Go out, let us know what's going on. Tell other people the great experience that you've had from listening to our podcast. And number three, send us messages. Send messages to me, gigready@gigrent.com, and we will get back to you. By sending us messages, you can let us know how we're doing. What are we doing? What do you want to hear? Are there topics that you want to hear about? Something you want to learn about that maybe you just don't know where else to go? Let us know. We would love to help you become a better event professional because this is the Gig Ready Podcast. Welcome back, everybody. This is Jordan Goodfellow, Gig Ready. We're excited to be here today. We've got the man, the myth, the legend, Kevin Tater, audio engineer, monitor engineer specifically, rock star in his own right. Tater, thanks for being here today. Appreciate having you.
Thank you for having me.
Tater Audio is a company I was introduced to a long time ago, actually when I first started with Linkin Park back in 2010. You've mixed a lot of the heavy metal greats over the years. What got you into the world of monitor engineering and talking about, you know, what drew you to that versus other parts of the audio world?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I don't think I was originally drawn to the monitor position. I was drawn to the just the sound and PA rental business. And you know, I landed at monitors a lot during that time. And, you know, I teamed up with another guy doing local gigs around Detroit. And he always kind of did front of house and threw me back on the monitors. And that's kind of where I learned, you know. So I kind of, in the end, as I started getting bigger and better gigs, I found more satisfaction in mixing the band. You kind of knew right where you stood, you know, right at the end of the performance or during it. There was no, you know, anything with an audience complaining or anything. It was just them, instant gratification. You knew what happened that night, and it was over and on to the next night. So I kind of just stuck it out there. And, you know, I think in the long run, I think it was a good move because I think really, I don't know now, but when I definitely first started, there was were monitor engineers, and the ones that wanted to go to front of house, and as soon as they got the opportunity, they did. So there was always tons of work for a monitor engineer. So, yeah. I just kind of stayed there.
Yeah, 100%. The actually, another monitor engineer I know who loved to do monitors always told me monitor engineers like the easiest gig because you don't have to please yourself; you just have to please someone else.
That is true, but sometimes that's hard to do. Maybe easy for him, but sometimes it's hard to do. And sometimes true. You have to mix something that you personally don't like. You're delivering what he wants or she wants, and you don't necessarily like that mix, but you got to sit there in it all night and try to enjoy it. So sometimes that's it can be tough.
Very true. Very true. How do you see your role as it fits? I mean, monitor engineer, your job is to make sure the band can hear and give the very best performance. But overall, when you look at the full audio team, you've got your, you know, your systems engineers, you've got your front of house, you've got your stage patch, you've got all the guys that kind of, where do you fit cohesively into that team? Because ultimately you're going to play other roles beyond just boom, I mix the band and go.
Yeah. It depends what band you're working with, what size tour you're on. You know, I did a speaking of Linkin Park, God, maybe it was 2 years ago now. You know, I did a Mike Shinoda solo tour, and there was no crew. It was me and the front of house guy, and that was the the whole audio team where, you know, on the current tour I'm doing now, Iron Maiden, you know, we have front of house, two front of house assistants, two monitor engineers, a stage patch guy, and then two PA techs. So, but, you know, I'm there to work. So in a big tour like that, I'll go in early. I don't mind sorting PA out, stage left, stage right, help them try to hang at least a few cabinets till my stuff comes in.
Yeah.
And then my stuff comes in, I try to sort it out and get it ready. And everything has to fall into a time space of when the carpenters are done and the riggers are done. And everybody has their own little time slots to fit in, and you got to be ready for that.
Yep.
And, you know, just try to get the job done the best I can as a team. You know, audio is a team, and then not only is the team, but is the whole crew working as one, and go from there.
Awesome. That's great. I always noticed you were so particular, like, boom, everything fit into this one. All right, this is the way it comes in. This is the way it goes out. It's like, whoosh, just nice sliced bread.
I've just always found it being neat, tidy, consistent, and doing the same thing, repetitiveness, just it cuts down on a lot of mistakes if you can do that. You know, if you're just winging it every day, you're going to forget stuff, and stuff's going to be different. And, you know, to me, I've always found the bands don't like it different. They want it to sound the exact same way every night in their ears or in their wedges. And other people want the cable runs the same way every day for their jobs. It's just, if you keep it neat, clean, and consistent, I just think it's worked for me.
Totally. I love the clean. In fact, I think that there were a couple of times I'd like walk through Monitor World and like, I don't know, you making sure that all the boys are keeping the floors clean and keeping people from leaving crap around. And it's great. I love the aspect of that.
Yeah. We're not savages. You know, us audio guys aren't savages all the time. We like to have a nice work area. And I especially do. So, I just think it lends itself to part of the job and part of especially the monitor job.
Yeah.
So we're not savages.
How critical is that relationship between you and the front of house engineer as it goes to working with the band, doing the show? Are you guys very siloed, or is there, you know, there's a lot of symbiance, if you will, that has to come between the two of you?
Well, yeah, I mean, there has to be. There's a definite order in the day, and especially within the audio of the front of house guy has to tune the PA, and there's certain things you do. As you know, I've worked with Ken Pooch Van Druten for, God, almost 18 years now, and we've done many, many bands together, and we don't have to talk much anymore. I know what he's going to do. I know when he's almost done tuning, and when he's through line checks, we don't have to, you know, you've been together so long, you know what's going on. But, you know, in the last few years, I've worked with so many great front of house guys. You usually click pretty quick. You know, Mike Fanuel, guy I hadn't worked with before, did the Mike Shinoda solo tour. Mm-hmm. Fantastic guy, great engineer, you know, and we got along great. So it was really good.
Yeah. How do you see the, you know, the main PA when it comes on and you got the front house guy, you know, you're doing a show, does that tend to impact the artist, significantly, or are you able to mix and create an experience on stage for the artist where it doesn't really create as much of an impact and they're able to really be present there?
Well, that once again kind of lends yourself to your last question about working with the front of house guy and knowing how they mix and all that stuff, because to me, how I've always worked is you have to incorporate the front of house sound into your monitor and stage sound, even with the in-ears you do. That's a big thing, is knowing what's going on out front, knowing what's kind of coming back from the PA system, and consistency of the front of house systems engineer and hanging that system the same every day. Keeping that consistent helps me stay consistent. And you have to have that relationship with not only the front of house mixer, but also the systems engineer tuning that PA to get the consistency on stage. Because, you know, we can make it sound one way when that PA is not on, but when you turn that PA on, it's 90 degrees different. So you have to work within the parameters. The PA is always, or hopefully always, going to be on while the show's going on. You know, that's something you strive for. So, you know, I see a lot of guys, oh, mute the PA, I got to do this, got to do that, mute the PA, blah, blah. I don't ever say that. I try to work and do my stuff while the PA's on and Pooch is tuning, because it's going to be on during the show. And yeah. I always think, when you listen to my monitors, at least my conventional monitors, and some of my in-ear stuff, it probably sounds a little thin, because I know as soon as he kicks on, it's going to fill in a lot of the stuff that's missing, yeah. and I don't need to add it in there.
Huh. Do you use, when you're running through your monitor tests, Pooch is out front, do you use virtual playback just like Pooch does in the monitor world side of things?
Yeah, well, we've incorporated it now where on Iron Maiden we have, you know, SD or Q7, Quantum 7 at front of house Digico, Quantum 7 at monitors, which I run, and I do the whole band minus the bass player. Mm-hmm. And my partner in crime up there on stage, Steve Gonzo Smith, he does monitors for the bass player. So we have virtual playback. When Pooch runs it, it's coming to my console and to Gonzo's console, so we can turn on the stage.
Huh. Very cool. Mm-hmm. And then, so you're listening. I mean, so really, it's almost like being at the show without the band. And
other than the back line roaring, yeah. It's pretty close. And if we can get the back line guys to play along, it's real close.
Do you ever have any... bringing up the second monitor engineer, I know another band that did the same thing a little bit, in that the lead singer had his own monitor engineer, yep. and then the rest of the band had their thing. How does that relationship work between you and Steve? And I mean, is it Steve's like pretty good with whatever, or are there some critical things you guys have to keep an eye out for?
No, I tell you what, with Gonzo, with Steve, he does Steve the bass player. He does Steve Harris, the bass player, mixes his conventional wedges and some side fills for him. And the thing with Gonzo really helps. Gonzo used to mix the whole band for mm-hmm. years. Yeah. So he was instrumental in my success when I was, you know, first started and new with Iron Maiden, just coming in, telling me about the guys and the mixes. And if stuff was wrong, he'd say, no, let's try this. So I really keyed off Gonzo. But when we're mixing the show, you know, it's each of us going at it and doing that kind of stuff. And we don't have much communication, but we do communicate. We have to noise stuff at the same time, so the one tech isn't running around doing different stuff. And, you know, Gonzo's instrumental on the loadout, because if he wasn't there, I'd have to get cases and stuff. He's down there wrangling that stuff on the floor, and I'm doing it up on stage. You'd have to ask him, but I think we were quite a good team.
That's great. No, that's awesome. Yeah. It's not very often that you have two monitor engineers on a job. And so understanding that relationship. Give me a quick picture of what your show looks like. When Pooch and I talked, we were talking about the fact that, you know, there's one way you manage the day. Load in, load out, all that happens. And then you get to the show, and that's like this, you know, that's that little slice of time that's just different. And, you know, what does that look like from a monitor standpoint? I mean, even down into, you know, are there specific times where you're PFLing and listening to certain things because of other things happening, that sort of stuff?
Well, I'm always, you know, the bands I work for, and you know, I'm mainly in the hard rock, heavy metal business.
Yeah.
The bands I've been doing for like the last, like, almost 20 years now have been mainly in that vein of music. I don't really have just one, like, an artist in a band situation. So there's a main artist, let's say, like, you know, say Jennifer Lopez, and then she has a band, right?
Yeah.
Where you have to focus on her all night and then just kind of worry about the band secondary. Where I don't have that luxury a lot. I work for, if there's five rock stars in the band, I got five principals up there. You know what I mean? If there's six, seven, there's that many principals up there that I have to pretend that each one of those guys is my 100% focus all night long. And since I have to do that, I'm bouncing between all those mixes constantly, you know, all night long, checking in on them. And I normally stay on the lead singer, but... anytime I have to give a cue to somebody or something like that, I'm always on their mix delivering the cue to be sure I hit it right, then bouncing back and forth. But I'm bouncing between everybody all night to give them 100% attention.
Yeah.
Not only my mixing, but my visuals. You know, I'm always a big proponent of you can't be buried in the desk. You've got to know your desk.
Yeah.
You've got to be looking out there. If you're looking out there and paying attention, to me, that is one of the biggest things that I see people not doing. They're buried in the desk. The band needs something. You're not seeing them, and then they lose confidence. So you gotta be heads up and eyes on the money out there.
I'm with you. In fact, I don't think I ever watched you or saw you look down at your desk ever. Anytime I would look at Monitor World, I mean, like hands flying over the desk, hitting buttons and stuff, and your eyes are. I mean, that was
right on the money.
Yeah, that eye. Well, the guy that pays the bills, you got to keep your eye on him, right?
That's right.
When you're so the show, you're working through everything. What are some things that can kind of come out of left field when you're as a monitor engineer? You know, same show every single night. Is there ever a time where stuff could just come out that you're not expecting, or is it all pretty much boom, boom, boom all the time?
There's always something that can come unexpectedly, and hopefully it's in that range. You know, we set up so many spares and so many things just to switch over at the push of a button. So anything like that, we're ready for it. You know, spare microphones, spare wireless, spare in-ear packs, spare ears. Between myself, Gonzo on Iron Maiden, and the back line techs, we're ready for it. And we have a pretty elaborate talkback system to know if something's going on or someone's feeling uncomfortable or something like that. And we can usually, knock on wood, we can assess it out pretty quick, you know. And also, I work for a lot of legacy bands, and they've been around the block. They've played these venues way more than once. And they can tell you if they're good or bad. So if they're bad, they know they're already in their you manage their expectations, but they've already done that themselves if they've been around for a while. And once that happens, they know those rooms aren't any good, and I can't make it change. So they're usually pretty good like that.
Okay, very nice. I'm going to come back to managing expectations in a second, because that's a really good one to talk about. Yep. But I wanted to ask you from a show standpoint, as a monitor engineer, is there a lot of cues that you're, you know, boom, as you go through the night? I mean, you're, you know, muting, unmuting, going through stuff, scenes and other things, or is it, what kind of movement does that carry?
Even a band that I'd say kind of is a throw and go band, you know, put it up in there and you know, you're set for the night, as long as, you know, little tweaks here up and down. Oh, I can't hear the guitar, bring it a bit. I set up scenes for every song, and with in-ears and even with wedges, there's cues all night long for different people. You know, guitars up and down, this up and down, vocals down, vocals on and offs. There's cues all night that are programmed in there.
Okay.
And I have a scene for every song. I don't do multiple scenes in a song unless it's something rare. But usually for a tour, I stick with one scene per song, and then anything in that song, I usually mix it manually.
Okay. Very nice. I was
always keeps my head in the game.
Totally. No, I was always very curious about that, because everybody has their own philosophy on scenes or not. And especially when, I mean, I remember back in when the PM5D RH and things like that came on, people were really like, you know, moving from an analog desk into the digital world. Everybody was really kind of iffy about, oh, you know, what's going to happen if I go to another scene and suddenly this thing was muted when this was, you know, when it wasn't. And
yeah,
I mean, I'm sure that's happened to you before, where something accidentally gets muted in a scene or something, and trying to figure it out.
It has happened, but I learned a way to build my scenes where that doesn't happen. It doesn't come up and bite me, because I have a way of doing it now that automatically checks itself when I re-go back through it and stuff. So I've learned a way that works for me, so that if I just recheck it at the end, that I know I'm usually pretty good.
That's awesome. Yeah. Managing expectations, maybe the one thing that you do more than anything as a monitor engineer, with working with those who perform day in and day out. When you first approach an artist, like for the first time, so when you went to Iron Maiden, you never worked with them before. You know, they have a level of expectation. I mean, they are at the top of their game. They are the best at their craft. They're filling stadium after stadium after stadium. What kind of expectations are you managing with them as you're mixing monitors, working to give them the very best, but at the same time, you know, helping them to understand, you know, in certain places there are limitations, there are things that can or have to happen. What do you do as you work through that?
Well, with them, they've been around long enough. Those each of them, all of them know exactly what they want. And you have to deliver that. You got to give them exactly what they want. And, you know, Bruce the singer, he's so intelligent. He's so smart. He knows not only, like, how his body feels from his stomach to what comes out, how it sounds. He listens in many different ways. He's not on in-ears. He's on wedges and side fills. And he knows where to go when he needs to hear certain parts. He knows where to go when he doesn't want to hear certain parts. And he feels vibrations through his legs, stepping on certain monitors that he wants to hear. He knows what's coming back at him. He's just so smart and intelligent that way. He knows exactly what he wants, and he's going to describe what he wants and tell you that. And same with the other guys. You know, they know their cues. They know what they want. They know when they're getting them. And luckily, I jumped in there, and Gonzo really helped me out. We do long rehearsals, which is nice. And, of course, we're in a small space. And we're doing band rehearsals, and then we move into an arena. We do a couple arena days, and then first week might be a little tough, and then we get through that, and then it's usually pretty good.
Do you find that their mixes ever change based on emotion or venue size or things like that at all?
The ear mixes, I will change them. They won't really ask for that. And Bruce, just a little bit. We get into some rooms that have some bad delay issues and stuff like that. In the Sports Palace, like in Mexico City, I can name a couple more, but we'll just throw some timing stuff in there, some snare and some guitars around in some spots where he wants it, just to keep him on time, and then he's usually pretty good.
As in, like, will you introduce delay into things in the monitors so like the slapback or something where it's hitting the wall or whatever that's coming back to him, or what?
That's a little tough. He just wants to hear the first direct hit. Make sure you can hear that. So I'll put it up in there. It's usually stuff when he's away from the drums. They have a pretty big set. So I'll spread the snare around, and the bit of the guitar keeps him on time. And
got it. Is there ever a time where you try, you know, let's say an artist is, boom, we want wedges. We love wedges. Are there ever times where you try and steer them towards in-ears or help them understand why that would be a better choice in certain scenarios?
Well, I haven't really steered anybody in a while to wedges.
Away from wedges to in-ears.
Yeah,
sorry,
okay,
that's what
yeah,
I was saying.
Even away, the bands I do are normally still both for different reasons.
Okay.
Some guys still don't want to use ears. They've tried them and don't like them, have had bad experiences. Some guys want wedges and ears. So a lot of bands I still do ever, I still have wedges and ear. I have a combination of both. I never, even with Mike on his solo tour, I still have subs on the stage and a Q wedge. And then I have for Mike, I have a kind of a roving wedge. If we have a guest and they didn't bring ears, I have a wedge for that. And I also use that same wedge for rehearsals when they come in and they don't quite have their ears in yet or their packs on. And Mike will just walk up to the keyboard and start playing the keyboard. Well, he can't hear it because it's in his ears. He doesn't have them on yet. So I have a little wedge that I just put it under dolly underneath it. And if somebody's just noodling around, I push it to wherever they want and put something through it so he can at least get started and comfortable if he's just messing around without having to put his ears on.
That's a great idea. I love that idea.
I call it a little roving wedge.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have thought of that, but being the professional that you are for 30 years, you were like, hey, this is a pretty darn good idea.
Yeah.
Do you have any like good stories of success where like one artist just, they wanted, like they needed to be on ears because wedges just weren't working? Maybe a new artist or somebody who was trying to figure out what they were doing.
God, in-ears have been around now. You know, the first time I ever used in-ears was with a band called Trickster.
Okay.
And I think it was 1992.
Wow.
And they had Sony body packs. I cannot remember what the earbuds were, but they were some sort of generic earbuds. And we had a wireless system called Ambrose. And it was actually a 5-watt radio station. And that was the first my foray into mixing in-ears.
Wow.
And okay. That's how long it's been. And usually when I get there, you know, the bands have already decided on what they want to do or not do. Now, Linkin Park, when I started, Dave, the bass player, wasn't on ears, and he was, you know, Dave, all of a sudden we were in the middle of a tour. He's like, I want to use ears. Okay. So got someone out to mold them. I can't remember where we were. Called JH Audio up. Got him two sets, you know, main and a spare.
Yeah.
And they don't sound check, you know that. So
yep.
He comes to the gig, and, you know, they get there right before the gig. He goes, yeah, let's try the in-ears tonight. Okay. So I had a mix dialed up. Never said anything to me all night. Never took them out, nothing. Gave me at the end of the night. Yeah, it's great. Keep that. Perfect. So, and, you know, he's used them ever since.
That's
and
awesome.
The same with Brad Delser. Now, he doesn't use ears. He uses the headphones.
Yeah.
And we got him these Pelter headphones, and we custom installed headphone speakers in the set of muffs he likes.
Yeah.
And now Brad doesn't want any sound in them. He just has a click track and at different points in time. It's not always there. It's just for cues and keeping him on time. And that's all programmed in and scenes and stuff. So, you know, with him and he took to it, you know, yep, that's what I want and no problems there. So they usually, when they're ready to go, I think they've done a little bit of homework on it, or they've been around it enough to know what it's like. So,
I did not know that about Brad's headphones. I always thought they were just, he didn't want the noise. So he just,
well, they were at one point. They were at one point just a set of Pelter, gun muffs.
Yeah.
And he started to want some click track and some different things. So I spent kind of a couple months of a downtime and, found speakers to put in them and mount them and custom paint them and, you know, make sure they looked right and felt right and they weren't too close to his ears. They were set way back. A lot of trial and error and cables and, you know, all kind of stuff, cable links and, came up with something he liked and we spent a lot of money. A buddy of mine who runs a drag race team, he sent me to their painter who paints their funny cars. And I had the headphones painted real nice. And of course, cost a lot of money. And of course he just put he bedazzled them and you know, you couldn't see the paint. So that was the biggest issue in the end.
Now you ran a cable to those and they ran to a standard pack.
Yes.
So, okay. Yes. All right.
Standard
wireless
pack.
Yeah. They operated like in-ears, but he basically used them as a glorified click track monitor.
Correct.
For the most part. Yeah. Okay. Hey, if that works and it keeps them on time, then that's what matters. Yeah. Just makes
because,
the show better.
Once again, you know, all the speakers, the wedges and the side fills we had on stage were really only for Brad.
Yeah.
Everybody else was on ears and didn't really want the wedges as a backup or anything. So the side fills and the wedges were for Brad to hear through his Pelters. And that's what the wedges were for also.
Got it.
To get him a stage sound that he was comfortable with.
For sure. What?
By the way, he's got, for people that don't know, Brad Delson, guitar player from Linkin Park, he's got phenomenal hearing.
Yeah.
And even through all that, he hears every little thing. So
he's paying attention, and that's a good thing.
He's paying attention. That guy pays attention. Yeah.
What's the toughest band that you've had to mix for? Like the toughest to please?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't know if, you know, they're all kind of maybe tough at the beginning or tough, you know, till you learn what they want. The tough thing for me is usually like, especially on Linkin Park, they would do these new album cycles and they would change directions and sounds and all that kind of stuff. So it'd be like, you know, at one point we were up to like 120 inputs, you know, so it was really figuring out the new songs and what people wanted to hear in those new songs and all that kind of stuff, which wasn't tough until you got the information. And once you got the information, easy to deliver. But, you know, those guys don't like to come in and say, hey, guitar up, guitar down. They just want to, they come in from a, you know, a year off, and I asked, hey, Mike, can we run a song? Oh, we don't need to run a song first. We're good. Yeah, I know you're good, but I'm not good, you know? So they would just start playing, and then you'd work into it. And, you know, they're such nice people. They're not going to yell and scream at you or anything. But, you know, they would play, and then they'd say, okay, I need this here and this here. And as they were learning the new songs and the new sounds, we'd build it from there. And they would rehearse for a long enough time where it wasn't crammed, and you weren't really that pushed.
Yeah. And you're taking, so in that point, I can't believe I never thought about that. Different albums, you're right, because, I mean, each album, Hunting Party, sounded different than Carnivores, which sounded different than Minutes to Midnight. I mean, every single one of them. So the sound, man, the things you don't think of when you're not doing audio. Do you ever have to take any creative license within that to be like, okay, let's see how they're reacting to what they're hearing and kind of watching their face and seeing how they're, you know, if you need to make a change or they're not hearing something right?
They'll let you know when they're definitely not hearing something right. Got it. And you can tell, you know, I mean, if you've been with a band for a while, you know, I used to work for Godsmack back in like 2006 to 2010. And I could always, and they had vocal mics, like five different vocal mics across the dead center one, then two stage left, far stage left, one stage right, far stage right. And I always noticed when Sully would go to the far stage left or far stage right, man, the sound just, I could just tell he wasn't happy. And then I realized, you know what, when he gets in those two zones, he's right near the PA.
Okay.
So I had to figure out a way to get it a little more consistent. When he was near the PA. So, because I could just tell, he never would say anything to me, but I could just tell by his body language, he just wasn't quite as happy there as he was everywhere else. So you learn by body language when someone's having a good night or having a bad night, and whether it's you need to help them with certain songs, they're not. Like I say, you keep your eyes on these guys for 2 hours, 2 hours plus a night, you know, 50 nights. In a few months, you learn when they're comfortable or uncomfortable.
For sure. The one of the things that Pooch and I touched on was psychology and understanding how to, you know, interact, how to get, you know, what you need from the artist. Because sometimes, you know, they don't know how to describe it, or they don't know how to bring it up. Do you ever find times where you need to interpret that, or like they're saying, oh, I want it to sound like this, but they really mean something, something
100%.
Else? Okay.
100%. You know, like you're saying, creative license. As a monitor engineer, you don't get too much creative license.
Yeah.
You get a little bit, and you gotta do some stuff, but it's really what they want to hear. And you gotta stay within that framework, you know, and that's what it's really about, making them happy. And you gotta research, like Brad, you know, go back to Brad Delson. You gotta research how a band like that, a younger band, started. That when they started, there was in-ears already out there and widely used. That band blew up so fast, they were never really on Wedges. And Brad had those headphones on in his basement, and that's how he was used to listening to sounds.
Yeah.
So you have to take all that stuff and how they started and came through the business and how they want to hear stuff. You got to take all that in and hopefully deliver what they want and hopefully understand what they want when they're saying blue and they really mean red.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. Technology, it's changed so much in the last, I mean, even in the last 10 to 15 years. What has made your life easier, but also what of technology has made your life more difficult?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think as a general question, technology hasn't made the monitor position, not just me, the monitor position easier.
Yeah.
When I first started, you know, we used very limited wireless and it was all VHF. And you know, the microphones were 1, 2 to 5 channels, and it, you know, one of them was always clean, right, on VHF, and very limited. Well, now, and wireless was never a worry back then. So through the years, this wireless and UHF's come and piling on the amount of wireless that's being used, and now all of a sudden, the monitor engineer is now the wireless coordinator also. Somehow it fell on him, and he's got to do all the wireless. So
yep.
Now that's made my job harder, but now there's been technology within that
yep.
that's made it easier to do that portion of the job. But overall, my job got harder as now I'm the wireless coordinator. You know, yeah. So there's been stuff along the way that's fallen in there. Yeah, it makes it easier, but it also made it harder first before they've got systems that make it easier. So, and digital consoles, you got to learn a whole new thing, but have they made it easier? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. But, you know, they definitely they give you a lot more options to do a lot more stuff. And, you know, being able to recall stuff that you can program in, you know, it's,
yeah,
you can't do any kind of level of tour without it these days.
Yeah. Gone are the days of the PSM 600s with the little switch, you know, A or B.
Yeah,
and
A or B,
pick the
buddy.
One that's
A
the worst.
They sounded the great, but man, it would be nice if you just had which one? Oh, yeah. They both are clean today. You know, it just doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't. Man, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, every tour and both corporate world, I spend more time in the corporate world, has to have a wireless coordinator of some sort. I mean, if you don't have that, you're dead in the water. I mean, you know, when we're doing corporate stuff, we're talking minimum 12 channels normally of just wireless on stage, not to mention comm.
You guys have comms, which we don't really have. Yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully, comm tends to operate in the 1.9 gigahertz world.
Yeah, let them go up there.
Exactly. When you first got into the business, so you said, you know, in Detroit, your buddy, he'd put you at monitors, you're at front of house, he's at front of house, you're at monitors.
Yeah.
What, was there ever a time where you had to go out and find work for yourself beyond working for him, or was it pretty consistent, just job after job after job?
Well, I was pretty young. I was still in high school, so I couldn't work all the time.
Yeah.
I had school. Summers I'd work for him. And then at some point, I had purchased my own PA system. And I was doing front of house for a band and monitors from front of house. So I was doing both. We didn't have a split and a monitor mixer. And I'd still work for him sometimes. And I'd usually, you know, I guess because, you know, you learn to mic the stage up and you plug everything in. And I just turn it up and you're standing at monitors at that point.
Yeah.
So that's how it came. When I owned my own PA, I never had a split or anything. I just had... you know, did it from front of house. And then I got lucky, and in the PA I had, another guy, not the guy, other guy I was working for, but another guy with a sound company had the exact same Hill console I had, these custom full range cabinets that were floating around Detroit at the time, from Gandalf Audio. Say a little shout out to Rick Michaels. We had all these same PA systems. Well, this other guy was getting way more work than me and getting busier. So he came to me and he bought all my stuff. And at that point, I had gotten a gig at Shoko down in Dallas, Texas, which was one of the biggest with Clare Brothers sound companies. And Clare ended up acquiring them years and years later. But I had worked there I worked at Shoko for 10 years. And then, you know, basically I did everything at Shoko back then. Business was a little different back then. Bands didn't have the independent engineer thing, wasn't alive and well then. It was if you were Eric Clapton, you used Shoko, and your monitor engineer and your front of house engineer worked there.
Huh.
If you were the Moody Blues, you didn't have independent engineers. They were a Clare account because their Clare mixers worked there. So you'd hire Shoko, and your mixers would go with the, you know, with the tour.
Yeah.
And that's how that worked back then. Well, about the mid-90s, that all started to change. And I think that started to change because of the relevance of off-the-shelf speaker systems were now getting, you know, people were using them. There was installs. Before, it was proprietary Shoko Prism, S4s from Clare, Phase Lock from Sound Image. Everybody had their own proprietary box, and you'd use that box. Well, I think when that started to go away a bit because of the boxes, L Acoustics coming in and JBL coming in and Adams and all these companies getting boxes that were good, the independent engineer started to come in at that point. And about 97, I left Shoko and became an independent engineer because I was getting hired to do gigs away from Shoko at that point because we were going on runs where the PAs were supplied at the venues. So that's when that whole engineer thing really, independent engineer thing really started to take off. And now you don't see engineers anymore really coming from the vendors anymore. And I guess it made it easy for the vendors if it sounded like shit. You know, it wasn't their mixer out there, right? There's no one to blame when it's your company guy mixing on your PA. But if it's an independent guy mixing on your PA, it's definitely the mixer. So nowadays, there's somebody to blame. So, but anyway, that's how it works now. But that when I started, that's not how it worked.
How did you? So you started getting hired away from Shoko.
Yeah.
How did you move? I mean, did Shoko kind of take you to that level that you've been at this high level. I mean, really the top of the industry at this point for years and years now. Was Shoko what got you there, or was there work within after Shoko that worked you up that ladder and worked you into the A+ level market?
Well, I can answer that two ways. Shoko definitely got me there because they were exposing me to artists I'd never be exposed to.
Yeah.
Knowing production managers and other crews that I would never have been exposed to. At Shoko, even though it was a very large company, the actual sound part, because they owned Verilite and developed Verilite back then, and that was all part of it. But the sound part, even as big as Shoko was, it was not very big as far as road employees. So you would work... Literally, you'd be on the road. Everybody was at least 300 days.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and if not more. So you were on the road all year long. And if you were mixing monitors on one tour and then the next tour was getting ready to go out, you were doing, you were the front of house systems tech, or you were the PA fly. It was because you just did everything.
Yeah.
And that giving me that base of knowing everything about setting up the systems, power, troubleshooting, all that stuff. I learned all that, got my base at Shoko. I'd known some obviously coming in by owning my own PA system, but I didn't know rigging, troubleshooting with other people and working with local crews and all that stuff. Those skills were honed in, doing tour after tour after tour with Shoko. And, my first real independent gig from leaving Shoko was Alice Cooper. He was a Shoko account. I mixed him. And I went independent because Alice was hiring me constantly away from Shoko. And I just said, well, I did that. And then I got another gig away from Shoko. And then I just kept parlaying it from there. And I had so many production managers that I had already become friends with throughout my days of working for all those other bands. And not only that, production managers, backline guys, and stage managers who now were coming up the ladder and becoming, those people now. And then hiring me. And I just kind of came up in that chain. And also I'd like to say a lot of hard work,
Yep.
Yeah. It's
the only way
to get where
there is no instantaneous.
Well,
boom,
you say that, but I see a lot of kids now these days, young guys come in and they go, I'm a production manager, 20 some year old. And I'm thinking, all the production managers I work with were, stage managers or guitar techs or truck drivers first and learned their way through before they could claim to be a production manager. I see a lot of LDs now. They come out of these schools and they say, I'm an LD. But to me, a good LD is someone that's rigged truss before, knows how to rig a point or two, knows the power scheme of their system. Then you become those jobs.
Yep.
But nowadays, I see a lot of people that jump right into them. Some do good, some do bad. But
yeah.
But don't forget, the advent of these schools is teaching that can happen. But you rarely see a guy, if ever, will come out of a technical school, not saying that they're bad, but mix the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
No, and I agree. I mean, because people like the Stones, they're looking, well, one, they know what their sound is going to be. They know what they want. And they know that they need someone that has the day in, day out, venue after venue after venue experience. I've run into my fair share of people from those technical schools, and I always appreciate the ones that come out saying, you know what? I have a lot of head knowledge, but I don't know everything. And I don't know road, because coming on the road is a totally different ball game than working. Even if you're coming, even if you're loading in and out of the same venue at your technical school 100 times, it's still the same place. Yeah. And you have to understand that there's a difference. There's a difference between, you know, the Palace at Auburn Hills and the Pepsi Center here in Denver, or Music City Center in Nashville, or, you know, rigging a festival in a Download Festival in the UK, or going to, you know, Rock'em Ring, Rock'em Park. I mean, they're all vastly different, and they take different skill sets, different, you know, and the humility of saying, okay, I've never been here, is critical in what we do.
They're coming out of there saying that they've got a real big head start, at least in my book.
I agree with you completely. What's the toughest part about what you do as a monitor engineer? What's the hardest thing that you see when you walk into, you know, each and every day, or just overall?
Well, you know, when you're mixing the band, you know, to me, my job's on the line every night. You know, you've got to perform every night.
Yep.
And that's the way I look at it every day. My job is, you know, it could be gone tomorrow, and I need to make the best of it and do my best work 110% every day and earn every dollar that they're paying me, and give them consistency and give them an honest day's work and a great mix. And not only that, the job, make sure when you go into these venues, you're not, you're working, even if you're a vendor, you know, you're not working directly for the band, you're a vendor, you're still representing the band.
Yep.
So you can't go into these venues or these places around the world and be jerk. You gotta show the band off in the right light.
That's right.
And especially if they're a good bunch of guys, you don't want a band to get a bad reputation because of a bad crew. And I usually say it starts from the top. If the employers or the musicians are not easy to get along with, usually the crew's not. It usually travels right downhill and pretty quick. So, but even no matter what the situation is, you've got to handle yourself appropriately with the locals and the venues and the house people and the promoters. You don't want to give anybody a bad name out there. It reflects badly everywhere. So not just worrying about getting your job done and getting my mix done and consistent, but you know, you got to be a team player, and you got to work with people. And even when people are mad at you and people are grouchy because it's early, or local guys just did a 6 in a row and they're sleeping at the venue for a turnaround, you know, don't make it any harder. It's hard enough as it is. Don't make it any harder. You know?
Wait, you mean you're not just hanging out with rock stars partying in the back room every day? That's not your life?
No, never has been, never will. You know, I say this all the time. In my, you know, it's going to be 33 years coming up. Oh, you know, August 8th is when I kind of call my start, because that's when I started at Shoco in 1987. Yeah. So it's 33 years ago. I don't really count my club days here and stuff like that, but yeah, it'd be 33 years. I've never been the in it to party with the band or the rock stars or anything like that. You want to do that, befriend them another way. I really, all the bands I've worked for in all these years, I really have less than a handful of musicians in these bands that I call friends. And I know everybody likes to say when they're working for a band, oh, you know, the lead singer's a buddy of mine. They're not friends until you have their phone numbers, they call you on holidays, and you've been to their house, and they don't just talk to you when you're on tour with them. You know what I mean? Yeah. Those are what friends are. They call you when times are tough. And I have, as far as musicians and bands, I have less than a handful that do that.
Yeah.
And the ones that I have, I appreciate. And we've become great friends over the years, even when I'm not working for them. And, you know, and we've made mutual friends together, introduced them to my friends, and they've become friends, stuff like that. So that's what I see it all the time, especially on the internet and Facebook. Oh, yeah, you know. Here's my buddy. You know what I mean? Yeah, we're best friends. But, you know, you go in his Rolodex, don't even have his damn phone number.
Yeah.
You know? He doesn't even know your kids.
Yeah.
Or your kids' names. So, that's to me, that's not real friendship. So I've only got a handful of the, and I'll tell you this, when we do talk and we do get together, we're not partying or anything. You know what I mean?
No. Nope. There's work to be done.
There's work to be done.
You know, when people find out when I used to tour with the band, with bands and stuff, they're like, oh, did you know, you know, did you talk to him? Did you hang out with him? What? And I was like, I stayed as far away from the band as I could, because as soon as the band knows who I am by name and like, there, if there's an issue, like if I'm the closest person and they know who I am, they're coming to me. They're not going to where they should go, which is the production manager. And they'll be like, oh, Jordan, this is a problem. And then now I'm accountable and I don't want to be that guy. That's the production manager's job. He like, he signed up for that and I'm going to let him do it. I'm going to stay I'm going to stay as far away from the band as humanly possible. And that surprises people. Like they don't understand that. I mean, as professionals, our job is to do our job, and our job is not to know the band, and it's not to hang out. No. It's to go out and execute, and that's what we do.
Unfortunately, with the monitor position, you gotta know them a bit, and of course they know your name and that kind of stuff. But you know, being, you know, I look at my relationship with Linkin Park. You know, 13 years I've worked with Mike and Chester, or 10 with Chester, and the other guys. Are we friendly? Hell yeah, we're friendly.
Yeah.
But I never crossed the line of a business relationship. You know, with Mike, I mean, you know, yeah, I think the guy's great, super talent. Even with Chester, you know, Chester every night would come up to me before the show, give me a kiss, and I love you, man, blah, 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 and then give him the mic, and he'd run out there. But, you know, were we really friends? You know, he didn't know my kids' names, you know what I mean? I didn't, you know, I did have his phone number, but I never called him, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, stuff like that, you know, you got to look at it in the right light. And
that's right.
But great human beings they are, and I respect them for that. And you got to remember, you know, there's 10 years. Even if we are friendly, there's a 10-year age gap between those guys. I mean, it's like we don't like the same shit. So, you know, there's a lot of things like, you know, do you get to talk to them? Do you get to meet them? Yeah, but you're not instantly friends with everybody.
Nah.
So,
nope,
it's just not the way it is.
Yeah, you're not talking about the kids' birthdays and all the other stuff that goes on with life and things that you do with friends, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
They have their own, and they have friends too, which is great. I mean, you can only have so many people that you are like good friends with, and it's just
I'll say this, and I know it's going to be broadcast out there. Maybe I shouldn't say it, but I'm going to, because you look at the band, you look at the bands as the same way. You think, oh, there's Linkin Park. I'm going to use that example because that's where the story comes from.
Yeah.
And you see them and you think they're all best friends and you think they're hanging out together. And then you find out that they don't. You know what I mean? And Mike, it was during right after we lost Chester, you know, Mike said to me, you know, I went to his house and he had all his friends there and he didn't know them. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. They all had their own little friends and stuff, you know? And that hit me. I was like, oh yeah, you're right. You know, as close as those two were, you know, Chester had a life of other people away from Linkin Park, as I'm sure Mike does, and they all did. But that kind of hit home with me. Oh yeah, it went. That's the way I thought about it. You know, so
interesting. That's a great perspective to help and better understand the music industry and where. I mean, and everybody. I mean, I hate to use the word hierarchy, but there's different levels. Like it's just, I mean, income, life, just everybody's in a different place, and that's okay. We love to do different things. You like heavy metal music. I'm not a huge heavy metal fan, and that's okay.
It was the era when I grew up. That was, you know, it was the popular thing then, and that's, I know how to mix it, and it's just lent itself to luckily I've stayed in that vein.
That's great.
But you're right. Now, you know, a lot of people forget, you know, I've never been a multimillionaire, and I don't think most people are. You know, we're working people.
Yep.
And, you know, we've done well. This is a good career. You can make a lot of money. But when you're in that range of making a lot of money, right, I don't care what they – money didn't change me. It changes you. You do different stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's, you know, it's hard to be on that level. They're operating at a little bit different level as far as, you know, like you say, that hierarchy.
Yeah, when you're talking about taking your private jet to whatever place you're going versus the guy that, you know, the rest of us that are flying coach on that, you know, on the cheapo seat back in the in the middle of the I can't even think of the word right now. I'm like the ship. It's not even a ship. I'm like, gosh. Oh my word. What are three things you need on every show? Three things that you need, Tater needs on every show. Doesn't matter what they are, they can be anything at all. But what are the three things?
Well, I always used to say to do a gig, not that I need. I always used to say to do a gig, you need three things. You need points, power, and people. It's funny you say that because that was always my motto. You got to hang that stuff above everybody's head, so you got to have some points, right?
Yep.
You got to have people. You got to have fans. You got to have stage hands. You got to have the band. You got to have caterers. You got to have everybody to make that thing go. And you got to have power. You don't have power, nothing's going to turn on. So that's always, to me, the three things that the big picture needs.
Yep.
The things that I need, you can add to that, is really clean frequencies nowadays. You just throw that on the end as a caveat. That's really the thing, you know, the three things I need. You know, I'm lucky enough to, and I have been lucky enough really my whole career, that I've never really had to use local gear. I'm fortunate enough that the gear I use starting in rehearsals is the gear I use every day. And I give a lot of credit to local guys that work for local sound companies mixing different bands every night on different gears. Their chops are probably way better than mine now because they're just used to dealing with different stuff all the time. And, you know, I'm one console, one this, one that. It's always the same gear. And you lose your chops that way, where those guys' chops are – it's probably spot on, you know.
Yeah.
So there, it's almost kind of, even though it's the same job, it's a different job. So really just some clean frequencies in the end of the day now, along with those three P's, are really what get me through. But, you know, you gotta have some catering in there. You gotta wake up, you gotta have some food to get through the day, some clean frequencies, and, you know, you gotta have some time. You know, a lot of times you're pressed for time. And if one department gets behind, everybody's behind. And I've been also lucky that a lot of the bands I work for, Iron Maiden, Linkin Park, Judas Priest, they never sound check. And that extra two and a half hours a day of no sound check really gives you time to get stuff right and dialed in, because you're really under the gun, you know, on 10, 12, 18 truck tours to get that done by a certain time if they have to sound check.
Yep.
And you like to give the opening act guys, you hate to slight them all the time. You know, you got to give them a minute. So, you know, you hate to be running them up to doors every day.
Here you go, guys. 2 minutes. Set your gear up. Yeah. Go, go. So if somebody wants to become a monitor engineer on the level that you operate and have operated for a long time, especially the young ones, they're coming out of a trade school. They're, you know, working the shop at Sound Image or at Eighth Day or at Claire or whatever. What are a couple of things they should be looking at right now for the next couple of years to be able to create the skills that they need to get to that level?
That's a great question. And once again, I'm going to answer in a couple different ways. Right now, in the midst of what we're going through, if I was a young engineer, I would, and I lived wherever I lived. If I lived in California, I'd be calling Sound Image or Schubert. If I was on the East Coast, I'd be calling Claire or Rock Systems Audio, or, you know, in the Midwest, one of those many companies in Nashville. I would be all over them. Say, hey man, can I have a few hours on a console? Like, I'm not, you know, I don't have as much time on a Digico or a Yamaha.
Okay.
Can I get in there for a few hours? I know the consoles are there. Can I set up in a corner and use it? I would be doing that as much as I can. And if you are in anywhere near any of the distributors of Yamaha or Digico or SSL, I'd be begging them to get to some room where they know there is one close to you and that you can use. I think this is a great time for that.
Yeah.
And I think I would have to think just about anybody you know, within limitations would let you do that. I don't, you know, I've heard a lot of people asking about that. And I've said this whole time, you know, I got a whole warehouse full of them sitting here now. If you're in the Detroit area and I'm here, stop on by. I have no problem letting anybody, We've had a few people take me up on that too, so I have no problem with anybody wanting to come and, you know, show things, show me things. However, yeah. You know, however it rolls down. But as excuse me, as what's been going on, is away from what's happening now. I've been doing a webinar, you call it, with Pooch, called Wrong End of the Snake, and we have guests on that we have relationships with. Over our career that we've worked with.
Yeah.
And we've had Megan Holmes on, who works at Eighth Day Sound. We had Robert Long on yesterday as production manager for Kiss, Motley Crue. We've had a lot of people like that who are in the hiring and firing decisions.
Yeah.
And when we ask them that same question that you asked me, what they say every time, which I totally agree upon, when they do a list of five things that they want from a young kid or new employees, never in the top five has been the job that they're hired for. That's never in the top five. Like, I'm going to hire an audio tech. I want that guy to know wireless. I want him to know, he's got to know smart. He's got to know the new L Acoustics processor. And he has to know these new Roadstar chain motors upside down and be able to take it. None of that ever comes into play. It's how well do they get along? Yep. You know what I mean? All those other aspects, it's never the job aspect, because the job, even though it's a big part of it, and I hate to slight the job end, it's all about how you get along on the road, how you get along with other people. Are you a team player? The knowledge of the job, everyone is willing to let you kind of gain knowledge as you go.
Yep.
And mold you a certain way. And they've got those people that I mentioned, and Janine Edwards and all those tour managers and stuff. They all have crew chiefs that they like to use from whatever companies, audio vendors, lighting, sound, pyro, video. And they'll let the crew chiefs, they know that those crew chiefs can handle those younger guys and move them along the way they need to be moved along, as long as all the attitudes and everything are in place first.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing, is your willingness to be a team player and your attitude, and can you live on a bus and live in and out of a suitcase in a hotel room. It's more about that stuff still to this day than whether you got an A at Full Sail.
Yeah, that's true. Those interpersonal skills are critical.
Yes,
to understand, and working with other people and bus, you know, being willing to learn bus etiquette and, you know, understand that Tater gets a middle bunk, not a bottom or a top.
That's true. That's what 33 years gets you in life, guys. You really want to strive to be an audio guy, that's what it gets you. 33 years gets you a middle bunk.
That's right. He gets. Well, hey, and you get your first pick. You're the first guy on the bus. And, you know, and so awesome. Well, as we wrap things up today, sure. The question I like to ask everybody as we end this is, you know, we're in the COVID. We're in this very interesting time, but we're going to be back to gigging someday at some point. What are two things that everybody can do, not just audio, but each and every person can do, that the next time they set foot at a gig, they can be more gig ready than they are right now? They can be more ready to do that gig and perform at a higher level than they were when we, you know, when this whole thing started.
Well, you know, at my age, I think, some of that's age appropriate. You know, if you're 20 or in your early 30s, you know, if you're still in pretty good shape, you're doing great there. I got to tell you, I would always be staying in touch with people.
Yeah.
See what's going on. Yeah, you have to call everybody every day, but a text now and then, an email, somebody you toured with before. I would keep in touch with people.
Yep.
Keep your name out there a little bit, at least people in your, I don't say inner circle, but your, you know, your touring circle.
Yep.
Also, I think for me at my age, it's like, you know, I'm relaxing a bit more now. So I got to be, you know, when it's time to go out, I got to start getting up early, staying up late, and, you know, getting all that kind of regiment back in and doing 10,000 steps a day, because that's what you do at a gig. If you don't do that for a few months at my age, you're going to, those first 2 weeks are going to be killer for you.
Yeah.
So I would, and I also, there is so much knowledge out there now on these videos. I would be watching these things. You got to remember, these people, these sound companies aren't working either. And these console companies and speaker manufacturers, they've all got touring people that that aren't doing the normal stuff, and they're willing to take calls and talk to you and help you and educate you. So stay educated. And lastly, I see a lot of this lately because, you know, you're on social media and you see it. I see a lot of people, my world's ended, my life is ended. I don't have a job.
Yeah.
And that, I hate that. I'm going to put that out there. I don't hate a lot of things. I hate that.
Yep.
I've had, you know, at my age, you lose friends early. You have friends that lose kids early.
Yep.
And that is when your world ends. Not when your job ends.
Yeah.
Not when the job you loved ends. Your world is not over with. If your family's healthy, everybody's safe, you got at least something to eat on the table, that's your world.
Yeah.
Okay? Your job is not your world. And yeah. I see that constantly on the internet, and it just drives me up the wall that you're healthy. You can, at this time being, there's help wanted signs everywhere. Take a temporary break.
Yeah.
You know, move on. Try something else, man. Try, it's use a skill idea. Working somewhere else and see if you like it. And it's not that I want to lose young people in this business or old people to other jobs, because the longer this goes on, if you're any good, you're going to get promoted if it lasts a year into this new job, and you may like it better. You know, we got to make sure that these young people are coming back. I understand that. But your world hasn't ended. Stay positive. Just keep busy. And if you need the money, there's tons of other jobs out there to work. It may not be what you want, but hey, none of this is what we want right now.
No, it's not.
So, and I think it's also a lesson to a lot of older people like me that took work. You know, I've always taken work for granted, and I always knew someday something would happen. I always thought it would be, you know, Chester one day saying, I don't like the way you mix and you're out of here and I'm out of a job and can't find another one. But it happens to be COVID, and that's keeping us away. And now I hate the reason it's happened. I don't like the deaths. I don't like people being sick, obviously.
Of course
but
not.
At this point in my career, you know what? This break is doing me a lot of good. I didn't realize I needed the rest. I needed to reconnect with a lot of people. I had more than just phone calls. I needed to see them. I needed to be home for a summer. There's a lot of stuff I needed in 33 years and spending a lot of time on the road that I forgot that I needed a break, and I should have been spending more time at home. And being on the road 300 plus days a year is not, I look back, really wasn't the greatest decision in my life. I could have done without the money, and as I'm doing now. And I also saw a lot of people that I respected now saying a lot of things like April 1st, I'm out of money and I need to get help and I need to go to these charities. And I'm thinking, a real road person's got at least 3 months backup. Okay. Yeah. If you don't have 3 months backup, if you're crying for help in April, man, you're going to be bumming. So yeah. I don't know why these people that quote unquote called themselves real road people didn't have that savings. And if they had hardship before then, I feel bad for them and all that stuff. But man, people, if you're in this job, you've got to have savings. We used to say 3 months, and now shit, I'm going 6 months to a year now saying that's how much savings you need.
Yeah.
So, but you know, as long as everybody's happy, healthy, and their families are happy and healthy, their world hasn't ended. The gigs have gone away. Okay.
Yep.
And
that's
we see how much people really care about them. No one's even, we're barely even noticed, right? Really, if you really think about it, right? Sports has taken a stance first, and people aren't even talking about our industry. So, you know, we all thought we were high and mighty. You know, I do a rock show. This is the most important thing in the world, that I can hang a PA system. Get out of my way. But it's not. It never has been. And I've never liked that attitude before this or even during this. So that's my two cents. Sorry.
No, it's great. I love it. It's
you know, I've got a lot of radical views on this stuff, and that's
dude,
part of them. And,
that's okay. I mean, I agree with you. Know. Savings, critical. Being prepared.
Savings, critical.
I mean, you never know when the next. I mean, we live in a world of where we don't know when the next gig is coming. And it could be. I mean, this is something that's happened to me before where it's like I'm coming to the end of a tour. And company I had been working for, like nothing was happening, nothing's going on. Thankfully, stuff came together. But, you know, you could be a week or two from the end of a tour and think that, crap, the next 6 months is nothing. I got to be prepared. And I think that that's incredibly good good wisdom there from the tater. He's got it coming.
Expand onto that now that we're on the subject, and I'm dogging everybody out, and I shouldn't be, but but even before the situation we're in now, I've seen, unfortunately, a lot of roadies younger than I am have you know, unfortunately lost their lives. And then I see these GoFundMe pages for these guys for their wife and their kids. And I'm thinking, man, you know, term life insurance for somebody under 50 is about, no more than $25 a month for about 250 grand. And I'm thinking, how did they not do that?
Yeah.
When you have, and I'm not talking about for roadies. I'm talking about people in general, even. How are you not spending $25 a month on $250,000 of term life insurance to cover your wife and kids if something happens?
I agree.
I see that a lot in our industry, and I'm thinking, man, that's like a day's per diem for a month, you know? And I see that, it just makes me think, man, what's the thinking going on there? And we're in such a volatile business, you need to be protected in every way possible with the proper insurances to cover your wife, family, your loved ones, whoever they are, husbands, you know, kids, whatever your extended family, your inner circle is.
And
I see it all the time. And I just think, man, as this goes on, it's tough. And I don't like to see that happen when there is things out there that can fix some of these issues for not a lot of money.
Yeah. No, I mean, heck, if you're out on the road, it's like three less drinks than, you know, across a month. And that and that pays for that month of term life insurance. Did you really need that other martini or that other margarita?
Right.
Or did you, you know, I mean, if you think about, I mean, I know it sounds, it kind of sounds mean, like, oh, well, don't tell me what I can and can't do. But long-term thinking, you know, we all have families. I don't know anybody out there that doesn't have somebody, whether it's mom, dad, kids, wife, aunts, uncles, whatever, you know, that's going to miss them if something were to happen, you know, doing something that at least helps to ease that pain should something happen to you, being that we live in an unpredictable life and unpredictable world. You know, I always carried stuff for my family, my wife, my kids. You know, if I were to die, I mean, my wife would always tell me, the money isn't worth it to me if you were to die. And I get that. Right. I get the money's not worth it. But then she doesn't have to think for 6 months, a year of like, how am I going to take care of the house? How am I going to pay the mortgage? How am I going to take care of the kids? Like those things help people heal, help people mourn, help them really get
through.
Can't
put that stress on them.
No,
it's enough stress.
Tough. So there you go. Term life insurance. Tater, are you selling term life insurance? Is that what you're doing now?
I'm not. You know, I own a little bit of term. I own mainly whole life insurance, and I bought them at a very, very young age.
Yeah.
And I really thought, I'm going to tell you the story because I'll tell you the truth. I thought I was getting ripped off. I thought I didn't quite understand whole, and I didn't quite understand term. I knew term was like car insurance. You know, you give it to them, you never get the money, but it's gone, right?
Yep.
Well, I bought some term to level up my whole life insurance, because whole life is a lot more expensive, but it's also an insurance policy that pays dividends.
Yep.
And I've had them so long now that they pay themselves because they're worth so much money.
That's awesome.
And this thing I thought that I didn't understand and I thought I got kind of ripped off on has been really my best investments throughout the years have been all the whole life policies I have purchased.
Okay.
And I keep a little bit of term just to you know, just a little cherry on top for cheap. You know what I mean? To increase that. And that's always had that, always will have it. And it's just a safety net, just like anything. And those are, you know, a lot of important tools to in life, and not only for this kind of job, which I don't know the facts of it, could be higher risk than most jobs, but man, we're in airplanes, we're traveling all over the world, you know, anything can happen.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough I wasn't smart enough, but I got some good advice at a young age and made a few right moves by the advice of some people that I listen to, because I always think I'm not smart enough, so I listen to other people.
Yep.
And you know, the advice was good, and you know, the time when you're doing 300 days plus a year on the road, and I just remember at Shoco, I was, you know, just turned 21, and I'm going to be 54 next month, and it's like the blink of an eye, it's gone. That time is gone.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another thing about this is, you know, you got to spend time with your kids. The time goes so fast. And being out there, you know, I see all these young guys, young families, they want to be on the road, on the road, on the road. Man, take a step back for a minute.
It's tough. I'm with
do
you.
Do what you want. That's not up to me, but I'm no, just speaking for my
thanks
my,
so
my
much for taking the time years. To listen today.
That's very
I
true.
Know that as a mean professional, wife and each kids, and every one of us want to be they, better tomorrow especially than we were today.
Not the
that's
biggest
why
fan
we created
of
the
on the Road
podcast.
Tour, just because I
this
was not
is
home.
A place
nothing
where professionals can come
with the road itself
and look
other than the fact
at what
that
they're
I wasn't
doing.
At home.
Look at how they're doing it
and
get better every single day.
In fact, it's funny, to this day, I still have the tendency.
We're not going
to
take corporate interests. We're not going to take sponsorship money. We want you to get better. Solely because that's what you want. So please
and,
give us some feedback.
That was like
I want to get
I was
better.
Like with the family at all times.
Podcasts.
I want to create
the idea of doing
just
anything
like
else
because
I'm on the road.
So if you have some value you
want
to give back,
yep.
ideas,
and
thoughts,
then something I'm home.
Questions.
Like, whoa, they have daddy
even,
or mom.
Even
you know
the ability to be
here.
A little critical.
And now
at
I find
times,
that I fall into those same patterns. Even though I'm home every day,
I hope you
have
a great
day. Stay safe out there and stay. Balance of like
okay, I need space.
Taking my boys for bike rides, doing things that aren't like stuck in the house have been really good for me.
That's great.
So, but hey, thanks for chatting, dude. I loved it.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
No problem. Anytime.
And
anytime.
Great stories. Learned some cool things that I had no clue actually existed. So thanks for coming. I appreciate it.
Right. Hope too many people don't hate me after my tirade, but
come on. Good deal.
I gotta say it like I see it. So
that's right. Awesome. Well, thanks again. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Jordan. Appreciate it.